I'm here with Norm Legend, and Norm has an interesting role in the autism community because he spends a lot of time looking at his well-known historical figures to try to determine if they are in fact on the autism spectrum or not. So, Norm, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm very flattered that you would invite me.
Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about who you are and some of your connections with the autism community?
I have really come to this late in life because it wasn't until 1996, I believe, that my son was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, and immediately I took an interest in the condition to the extent that I read everything then available, and there wasn't much.
Oh, so you read what? Books?
Well, I read, Uta Frith's book, I think Uta Frith was the major work at that time. Tony Atwood was just bringing out his book on Asperger's syndrome, and I went to listen to Temple Grandin. I read her book, Thinking in Pictures, but as I say, at that time there wasn't a whole lot available, and all of a sudden, because people began to become aware of the condition and people developed an interest in what it was all about, that other books began to appear. And I started to develop my book, Diagnosing Jefferson, beginning around 1998. By the time my book came out, there was a good body of literature on the subject.
So what made you decide to write that particular book? And you've written other books as well, right? But that was...
Yes. What made me decide was matching idiosyncrasies that I saw in my son with those that I was reading about in the Jefferson biographies. And I was whipping through many different Jefferson biographies, and I had been reading them for years. But I was right in the midst of reading the six-volume biography by Dumas Malone, and I began to scribble every quirk that he mentioned, and I was surprised that although he mentioned idiosyncrasies, he didn't really look into any pattern or any relationship among them that might have led him and anyone else to the same conclusion that I reached, that they meant something diagnosable, if there is such a word. At any rate, when I found 20 or so matches between my son's behavior and Jefferson's behavior, I became extremely interested in doing something about it. And when I found 50 matches, I decided right then and there that I was going to write a book. And it was a two-year project. I asked Temple Grandin right away to come on board with it and write comments for the book, but she wouldn't do it until she saw a lot more detail. Because she's so fact-oriented, she wanted to be satisfied that there was enough detail to attract her and that I shouldn't be generalizing. She went through three drafts of mine before she agreed to become a part of it. And I'm glad she was so insistent because it turned out to be a better book than it might otherwise have been.
Can you talk about what were some of the things that really started jumping out as you were learning about Jefferson?
Well, there was a reticence on my son's part to engage physically, even though we tried on a number of occasions to give him hugs and to be close physically. He would shy away from that. That's one of the first things we noticed, and of course it worried us until we until we got a diagnosis. But he wasn't diagnosed until he was 12 years old. And until then, we went through a lot of different professionals to come up with some answers. But it was the Asperger's diagnosis that seemed to clear up a lot of the questions that we had. And really, it was a relief to be able to not just give it a name, but to recognize that what we were dealing with. He also perseverated a great deal on topics that were of absolutely no interest to us, such as the details from various motels that he picked up from reading their little guidebooks. He seemed interested in memorizing the amenities available in one chain after another. Also, automobiles. I had to pick up for him the various descriptions of cars from car dealers in order to satisfy his voracious appetite for detail. So these sorts of things jumped out at me as symptomatic and very much like Jefferson's interests in rather obscure topics.
But how do you get from memorizing details about motels to writing the Declaration of Independence? I mean, that's a big difference.
Well, yeah, he was capable apparently, people who read the Declaration of Independence don't see it as don't see the same thing that I see in it. It's an indictment. It's a bill of indictment against George III, and the details of that indictment are enumerated very specifically. It's not really the abstract document that we that Americans have been taught to regard it as being. It's a very detailed recounting of what he considered to be George III's crimes. So, in that respect, I would say it falls into the fact-based syndrome that Jefferson exhibited.
And you mentioned in the book, you talk about some of the he has a relationship with one of his slaves.
With Sally Hemings. I refer to that as a very logical choice on his part because, number one, she was the sister, the half-sister of his late wife. So she was family, in a sense, in addition to being technically his slave. She was also three-fourths white. And when they connected in Paris, she made that choice freely because in France there was no recognition of slavery. She was a free person. She was 15 years old when they connected, but she was able to determine on her own that this was a relationship worth entering, partly because she had the example of her mother. Elizabeth Hemings had accomplished pretty much the same role placement at the death of John Wells, who was the father of both Sally and Jefferson's wife, Martha. And as a result, I think Elizabeth encouraged Sally to go to France when they needed an escort or a chaperone for 8-year-old Mary, Jefferson's second daughter. The connection, I think, was based on her ambition to some extent and his need. He had just come off a romance with a married woman, Maria Cosway, and that turned out to be a great disappointment. It cost him dearly because he showed off for Maria and broke his wrist. And he was laid up with that just about the time Sally arrived in Paris. The image of his late wife, by the way, because they were so closely related. And the testimony to the success of that relationship is that that it lasted 38 years until he died. And by my count, they had 8 children together, 4 of whom survived. And really, it's a picture, a prominent picture, of America's mixed race legacy or heritage.
When you said she was three-quarters white, so do we know what her skin color actually was?
It was, no, we don't know, except that it was darker than most whites are thought of as having. But in the 1830 census, when a census taker visited her and her two sons, he put all of them down as white. So, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, on many days in the summer, I look more tan than I do the rest of the year. So she appeared very light skinned.
And is that the only like third party interpretation? Because obviously, like at that point, he's a pretty big guy, and so, you know, maybe they're like interpreting things positively in his favor somehow.
Well, she also didn't have a lot of the characteristics that we associate with Negroes. She had straight hair instead of kinky or nappy hair. Her nose was not as flat as you would find among African Americans. It was kind of pointed at the end because it was, this is according to contemporary descriptions. Her eyes were hazel, not brown, and they highlighted the yellow highlights in her eyes were prominent. So she was described as golden-eyed by contemporaries. She was in appearance as nearly white as an African American can be.
And, but yet he knew that she was descended, she was three-quarters, she was a one-quarter African-American.
What do you say, he knew that? Well,
he knew that, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean.
Well, see, at the time that his wife died, she exacted a promise from him on her deathbed that he would never remarry. Because she didn't want her daughters to have a stepmother. She had a stepmother, his wife, and she didn't want that to happen to his daughters. So she got that promise out of him, and in the room at the time was 9-year-old Sally. She heard that. She and her other sisters, all half-sisters to Jefferson's dying wife, were there at the end, and they were very much aware that he was committed never to remarry. Okay, the expectation, the unreasonable expectation by anyone else would be that he would become celibate for the rest of his life. Well, that wasn't going to happen. And Sally knew this, and Sally's mother knew this, and her sisters knew this, and I believe that there was a lot of conversation about later on, especially when Sally developed, and by the age of 14, there was a lot of conversation about the possibilities for at least one of the daughters, Sally, to imitate what Elizabeth Hemings had accomplished with John Wales, father-in-law to Thomas Jefferson. And that's my take on the subject.
And this is interesting. I mean, I don't know tons about early race relations in the U.S., but one, I mean, and you'll have to excuse my source, but I was watching the 80s TV series called North and South that has Kirstie Alley in it and Patrick Swayze. And one of the things that comes up in that TV series is Patrick Swayze's wife. She looks totally white. I mean, very, very, very white. And then it's found out that she's descended from an African American line, and her grandfather or something like that. And this becomes such a perceived tragedy that she runs away from Patrick Swayze. It causes all this drama, and it's this really terrible thing. If anyone were ever to find out, it would totally disgrace Patrick Swayze's 1830s family. So, I mean, this is in the South. I guess Jefferson's not in the South. How is that sort of stuff perceived? I mean, this is a really interesting scenario, is it not?
I think the relationships among blacks and whites were a lot more informal and regular than legend has led us to believe. I remember I lived in Louisiana for a time, and I had a lot of conversation with African Americans, both light skinned and dark skinned. And I remember one coming over to me and pointing to his eyes. And he said, "Where do you think I got these blue eyes?" So this has been going on. These relationships have been going on since slaves were first brought to this country in the early 17th century. And it's a matter of doing what comes naturally, but we don't talk about it a whole lot because, in deference to those who have felt threatened by the social stigma that was attached to mixing, we've looked away. We've even exaggerated the separation. But behind, under cover of darkness or behind a locked door, there was an awful lot of this stuff going on, and there's no sense denying it. And in the case of Jefferson, we can. Because the guy was so scrupulous about keeping records of his expenditures and his whereabouts for almost every day of his adult life, we can pretty much trace relationship with Sally on that basis. As a matter of fact, the historian from the University of Mississippi, Winthrop Jordan, was able to track every pregnancy of Sally's to Jefferson's having been at Monticello 9 months previous. So this is something that we'd better be ready to admit has been going on for centuries here.
How is that perceived in the era? Was he taking some kind of a social risk by this relationship?
Yes, he... As a matter of fact, in 1802, in September, in the Richmond newspaper, a Federalist newspaper, the Richmond Register, a series of articles was started by a man named James Callender, who was a very disappointed office seeker that formerly had been friendly with Jefferson. But he began to expose the relationship. And, of course, everybody expected Jefferson to deny it. Well, instead of denying it, he just didn't talk about it at all. And that was his way of making it go away, making the scandal, so-called scandal, go away. And remember, in 1802, he was already president, and he had already decided that he wanted a second term, even though he had only a year and a half before begun his first term. So he was exposed, so to speak, but he didn't let it bother him. And what's even more significant, he continued the relationship until he died in 1826 and had more children with her. And it was, to my way of thinking, not a matter of his having taken a submissive slave, but rather a relationship that was entered freely and romantically on both sides, even though there was a great age difference. He was 30 years older than Sally. Nevertheless, in those those days, that was not an unusual situation.
Hmm. Is there any ambiguity as to the relationship actually existing? I mean, do we have like DNA evidence and the kids and all that kind of stuff?
Oh yeah, I've met descendants of the couple, and we discuss all the time that the links that they trace back, and they can document a lot of this stuff. So there's no doubt in the minds of anybody who is looking at this objectively that this really happened, and we have the DNA evidence to back up some of it. But we also have, and this I put in my book, Diagnosing Jefferson, we also have the logic of the situation. At the time they connected, he was very much, the opportunity was very much in front of both of them in Paris, and the need was clear, and the ambition by Sally that we can deduce from her experience and her family and the Hemings family was present. So we just go from there logically, and to my way of thinking, it was a totally acceptable circumstance that we can look back upon now as having given prominence to our race mixing. Of which lately we've become rather proud.
Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting. Was this when they were together? Was this his only relationship, or did he have relationships with other women as well?
Oh no. According to his account books, which tell his whereabouts, it's everything he spent money for. There's just no way in the world that we could regard him as having been, either of them as having been disloyal. I think, frankly, it was a romance that was very deep and profound.
And did he take her out publicly to social events and all of that sort of stuff? Was she publicly recognized?
In Paris, yes. Not social events, but shopping, definitely. Out shopping and walking about in Paris. But at Monticello, no. She stayed put. And that was because of the prevailing prejudices of the community. Now, they may have walked together in Charlottesville. I would guess they did. In town, because it was his habit to shop at a few stores, one of which was owned by the mate of the. Well, all right, let me back up and describe that. There was a man named David Isaacs who operated a general store in Charlottesville, and that's where Jefferson frequently shopped. Isaacs had a common law relationship with a freed slave named Nancy West. Nancy West and Sally Hemings became friends, and we know this because Sally's youngest son, Eston, married Nancy West's daughter, Julia Ann. So there was some open mixing, and Jefferson could have been and probably was seen with her at times in Charlottesville. Charlottesville had quite a few freed slaves living openly, even though the Virginia laws at the time were so vague as to make it unclear whether this was whether they should even have been remaining within the state. There was a statute that was adopted in Virginia that any freed slave would have to leave the state. That way they get rid of any possible troublemakers. But that did not always happen. There are many who stayed on. And the law the lawman looked away from such things. Again, there was a lot of informality that we don't realize was applied in these situations.
And so Jefferson, with his position, it wasn't like he could just say, like, hey, you know, hey guys, I'm one of the founding fathers, therefore, you know, like, I can do whatever I want. Like, he actually had political liability with this, and it could have really caused him a lot of problems, but I guess he somehow managed to override that.
The fact is, there were times when he did say, consider who I am and cut me some slack. There were times when he did, especially when he realized he was going broke. He began to borrow heavily from just about everybody. The contractors who were working on the rebuilding of Monticello, merchants that, with whom he shopped regularly in Charlottesville, anybody who was available to dig into his pocket and help out, Jefferson had no hesitation about asking for help. And as it turned out, when he died, he was deeply in debt, over $100,000 worth, which by today's standards would have been over $2 million. And they had to auction, they had to shut down Monticello and auction everything off.
And so what happened with her and her kids after he died?
Well, her children had been freed by a promise that he had made back in Paris. Even though she was only pregnant with her first, they agreed that if she returned to the United States, where she would be a slave again, that he would free all children that they would have together. Significantly, that phrase, all children, came through even though she was only pregnant with her first. So apparently they were planning a relationship.
Is this something that was written?
Well, it's been published as a portion of a reminiscence by one of her sons. Later in the 19th century, he spoke to a newspaper reporter in Ohio, and he described the promise that that Sally exacted from Tom before leaving Paris. So we have secondhand evidence through her son, because of her having told him or described. Now, there were some things that she apparently told him that were not true, like the first child died shortly after they arrived in the United States. And we know that's not true because that child was seen later by this fellow Callender, or not by Callender, but by others who reported it to Callender when he gave his when he wrote his account in the Richmond newspaper. So, but we do have testimony by contemporaries of what went on between the two, and I put a kind of a romantic spin on it. I've written a novel called Sally, Mistress of Monticello, which I'm now trying to get a publisher for. And I think, dignifies the relationship a lot more than our having regarded Sally as a submissive slave who yielded to the lust of this master, Thomas Jefferson. I don't think it happened that way at all.
Hmm. Very interesting. So, We've talked a lot about their relationship. Maybe can you talk a little bit more about have you looked at others? I mean, for example, Simon Baron Cohen has looked at Einstein and Newton and whether they were on the autism spectrum. Have you looked into many other people?
I did. I brought out a book. I had a book published called Asperger's and Self-Esteem a couple of years after I wrote about Jefferson. And Einstein and Mozart were in there, and I noticed that in the biography of Einstein by Walter Isaacson, he has a footnote that is critical of both Simon Baron Cohen and myself for pegging Einstein with Asperger's syndrome. However, one thing that Isaacson overlooked, well, he said that it couldn't be true because Einstein had a lot of friends. Well, the fact of the matter is, those friendships were pretty much one-sided. People with Asperger's have a tendency to attract those with high intelligence have a tendency to attract the attention of others, and while there is a friendship established by such an attraction, it's not always reciprocal. As a matter of fact, the American Psychiatric Association, after I pointed that out in my Jefferson book, came out with a revision in the year 2000 saying that a lot of friendships may develop in midlife, but they are usually one-sided. And this is what I think Isaacson overlooked about those friendships that he claimed exempted Einstein from being considered to have had Asperger's. I went on and I also put in that book people like Orson Welles and Bela Bartok, the Hungarian composer, and Oscar Levant, the pianist who popularized Gershwin's music, and Glenn Gould, the pianist whose biographer also happened to be his psychiatrist, and said definitely that he thought Glenn Gould had Asperger's. And quite a few others are in there. And by the way, this book was republished in France, so it's getting around pretty well. I have Marie Curie in there, Paul Robeson, the singer, Carl Sagan, and Charles Darwin. So, yes, the answer to your question is I have considered others.
Now, I mean, people who look at this stuff today would say, well, this is crazy. The only way to make a real diagnosis is through parental interviews and, interviewing the person and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, they're absolutely...
And even then, sometimes the diagnosis gets disputed.
Yeah.
So...
Well, they're right. It's really not a diagnosis. It's really a supposition that they belong on the autism Asperger's continuum because their behavior fits the criteria that have been outlined by the American Psychiatric Association.
Hmm.
No, there's no way to diagnose a dead person. There's only a conclusion you can come to based on what you know, especially what you know of the earliest of their lives when they are exhibiting classic symptoms and haven't yet begun to adjust things like eye gaze, etc. Temple Grandin, for example, when I first met her back in 96, I think it was, she couldn't look me in the eye. But she trained herself to fix her eyes on other people's eyes, so she's overcome that situation. And people with the condition do learn make some social adjustments. And there are many, I'm sure, who cannot be recognized as having Asperger's syndrome because of having adjusted to such a great extent. And as far as I'm concerned, they don't have to adjust for me, but they do because I guess it makes they believe it makes life easier.
Right. I kind of view it more as a developmental issue, and that you can develop a long way past it. How far you can go, I don't know, but I feel that a lot of improvement is possible. It seems to me that that's what you're describing.
Yeah. If you call it improvement, I'm inclined to accept people as they are, and I don't like anybody to believe that I want to change them. And for this reason, I was perfectly content with Temple when she couldn't look me in the eye, but now she can and does, and that's fine. But it wasn't that important to me.
Mm.
And Temple, by the way, insisted on doing my doing the foreword for my second book, Asperger's and Self-Esteem, I didn't even ask her. She told my publisher she was going to do it, and that was it. So nobody gave her any ifs, ands, or buts about it, because she's a very dominant personality, and I'm glad of it, because she was on my side and helped me get published.
Yeah, right.
If I had.
So the well-known people then from the past that you've looked into, like who would be your top five as having the strongest traits on the spectrum, as you would be most confident in diagnosing them?
The strongest traits?
The ones that you're most certain of.
Well, I'd start off with Glenn Gould and Paul Robeson, who, by the way, was the only one that I described in my book that I actually met and talked with on several occasions. Let's see, Oscar Levant, definitely. You wanted five. Okay, let's take Thomas.
The five that you're most certain of. I haven't really heard of any of these so far.
Okay, Glenn Gould, the pianist, Paul Robeson, the singer, Oscar Levant, the pianist, Thomas Jefferson, the violinist, by the way. He was one of the top five violinists of his day before he broke his wrist. And you wanted five. Okay, let's see. Let's go with Mozart. And I'll team Mozart and Einstein as a fifth place tie. How's that? As a matter of fact, frequently, or I shouldn't say frequently, but occasionally, I'll run into a piece of literature. I'll go to a movie like the movie Adam, and I'll hear the names Einstein, Mozart, and Jefferson grouped. And I'll see it in books about people with Asperger's. Well, you know, I whisper to whoever is with me, where do you think they got that? They got that out of my book, Asperger's and Self-Esteem.
Well, that's pretty cool. So taking, like, Einstein, for example, how would you have picked that with him? We'd have a lot more data on him now.
Yeah, He was fixated. Classic fixations never did really accomplish all that he wanted to in scientific research. His early days, he was very captivated by his own perseverating on. Various scientific subjects when he was a young man. He didn't get along with his teachers because he was telling them how to do their jobs, because he just didn't go along with the formula of the relationship between student and teacher that was prevalent at the time. Different in every respect from his contemporaries, I don't know what else I can say about him except that he's a far more interesting personality than we give him than history has given him credit for being. We think of him as a super intellectual who is so profound in his theories that the world couldn't run any longer if we didn't see it obeying the forces that he described. But as a person, he had the classic quirks that you would associate with Asperger's syndrome in his relationships with other people. And I do recommend that for anybody to believe what I'm saying about his having been on the continuum, to please get into the biography that Isaacson wrote and see for yourself what I'm talking about. I also have the same feelings about Mozart. who, by the way, was bullied by his father to a great extent, and seems to have succeeded at two levels despite it. He was a child prodigy as a pianist, but later as a composer, and did less performing in later life. He had quirks that out the wazoo, as we say, and and you have to remember that of the hundreds of quirks that we can identify among various people with Asperger's syndrome, no two people are alike. One will have a set of 30 or 40 that we can identify. Another one will have 80 that we can identify, and maybe only on 10 of those idiosyncrasies will they coincide. Will these two people that we're describing coincide? So no two Asperger's people are alike in that respect, which makes the entire syndrome an interesting study.
Right.
But we can, if we go along with the American Psychiatric Association, we can identify the condition. And notice I call it a condition and not a disability, because frankly, I look at it from the standpoint of Asperger's having, in fact, enhanced some of the talents that were latent in these people.
Have you ever looked at Ayn Rand?
No, and probably it's a prejudice on my part because I'm so opposed politically to her conclusions.
No, she can be very polarizing. There's an interview with her in the 50s with Mike Wallace, and 50 might be early 60s, and you can see in the beginning of the interview there's a dynamic where she wants to dominate the interview, and like Mike's like, well, can I jump in? And she's like, well, hold on, let me finish making my point. Can I make my point? And they kind of go back and forth for a while, and back and forth until finally, like, Mike's like, okay, you know, now, you know, you gotta let me talk.
Right.
And it was interesting to see, like, she has such a strong way about her. And I mean, when you think of little professor syndrome, it's I don't know. I mean, it's not obviously not enough to make a diagnosis, but it's just very interesting to see that dynamic play out in the interview.
Yeah. By the way, the man who came up with that phrase, the little professor syndrome, Lawrence Osborne, visited me here in Kansas, and in his book American Normal, he has a chapter called Diagnosing Jefferson, where he describes some of the behavior that he recognized in my son, and he seemed to be very interested at the time in this project of mine. Called me and said, I want to come out to Kansas and interview you and all that stuff. And he later went on to do other topics, but in his book American Normal, he deals with what he calls the hidden world of Asperger's syndrome. At any rate, in the New York Times Magazine section, where which he wrote for, that little professor theme first appeared to my knowledge.
There's been diagnoses of positive people like Einstein and Mozart and, you know, positive role models. What about negative role models? Hitler or, some of these, you know, people that have done bad stuff. Seems to me if we're going to get to the bottom of this sort of thing, then we need to look at all aspects of it.
Yeah, occasionally I read in a newspaper that some young man who was arrested for this, that, or the other thing had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, and this happens infrequently. And I agree that it's quite possible that there are evidence out there of negative behavior by people with the condition, but I haven't made that a part of my study. I'm not ignoring it. I'm just not doing anything about it. Excuse me. Except to admit to you that it exists.
Right. Cool. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about which we haven't covered?
No, I can't think of anything, and my voice is giving out, so maybe this is a good time for us to be quitting. I'm not sure. But I've,
all right. Well, that sounds...
I hope it's been constructive for anybody who reads or listens to it. And again, I appreciate the invitation to take part in this.
Norm, thanks for participating.
Okay, and thank you, Adrian.